If you'll take your Bible, turn in it to Matthew chapter 5. We're going to continue this morning actually with the same passage that we looked at last week. I felt that there was a portion of this that I wanted to pay more attention to today. But before we look at that verse, I came across a set of New Year's resolutions that a person came upon, that they wrote out that they wanted to, in a given year, wanted to become more like Jesus. And so they described what they saw as being more like Jesus, and they wrote it out on a page, and they said that they wanted to hang out with more sinners, they wanted to upset religious people, they wanted to tell stories that made people think, they wanted to choose unpopular friends, they wanted to be loving, kind, and merciful, that's good, they wanted to make wine, they wanted to go camping with their friends, and they wanted to take naps on boats. And so that's this person's image of Jesus. And I find that to be a kind of entertaining image of Jesus, but also illustrative of the way we approach Jesus. You see, there's a tendency in all of us to look at Jesus as a reflection of ourselves in a way. As a matter of fact, we'll read our Bibles like we used to read the Where's Waldo books. My generation will know what Where's Waldo is. So who knows what Where's Waldo is? It was the best book if you grew up in the 90s, was Where's Waldo? And so if you didn't know what Where's Waldo was, just out of interest, who does not know what Where's Waldo is? Everybody knows. That's wonderful. I don't have to explain it. So you'd look and look to try to find Waldo, and you'd have to hunt and find all the things that aren't him, that look like him, and so on, to find what Waldo is. It's the way we approach our Bibles sometimes, our New Testaments. We go looking for the things that we think Jesus ought to look like, and those are the things that we latch a hold of. And the rest of it, we, by and large, dismiss. We may not do it intentionally, but it is the way that we approach it. And so, it is a fact that many of us have walked away from our Bibles, this is across the board in the world, with versions of Jesus that are not derived from the Scriptures, but are imposed upon the Scriptures. And so, there's a liberal version of Jesus. The liberals are very glad to bring Jesus into their camp, and he is very concerned about the poor, and he is opposed to authoritarian government and these sorts of things is the way that they look at Jesus. He is very, very compassionate and merciful to absolutely everyone and in exactly the same ways. Then there's conservative types of Jesuses that are out there that are really, really worried about sex and are really angry at people who are involved in sin and very aggressive about talking about hell. And then there is radical versions of Jesus that are looking to overthrow political systems. There's the introvert Jesus, who's happy to get off by himself and do prayer times for hours on end. There's the charismatic Jesus that is really concerned with miracle working and speaking in tongues and prophecy. And then there's the end times Jesus, who is just so focused on how it's all going to wrap up at the end, and that's the only thing they pay attention to. And all of these things are the Where's Waldo versions of Jesus. And it's almost as if a person goes looking for Jesus, and they look down at the bottom of a well, and they think they see him there, but when what they in fact are seeing is their own reflection looking back up at them. This is the way that we, by and large, if we're not careful, will approach Jesus. But the real task is for us to go to the Scriptures and let the Scriptures not reflect us, but for us to in them see the reflection of Jesus, and not for him to be conformed to us, but for us to conform ourselves to him. Because the failure to do this, if we don't do this, is a failure to be in a position of influence in our culture. If we allow Jesus to reflect us rather than us to reflect Jesus, we will find ourselves simply being like the rest of the world. We will cease to have an impact. To use Jesus' language, the same verses that we looked at last week, we're going to read them in just a moment. We will cease to be salty, and we will cease to be light. Jesus, once again, reading Matthew 5, verses 13 through 16, says this, "You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven." Now, last week we spent time considering what it means to be salt and light. I want to consider today how it is that we as a people can at times cease to be salt and light. How we can heed this warning that Jesus gives, that it's possible to lose your saltiness and it's possible to hide a lamp under a lampstand. And I want to consider from a theologian from the last century who thought about this in a very helpful way to understand exactly how it is that we can do this. That theologian's name, he was in the early part of the 1900s, was a man by the name of Reinhold Niebuhr. And I know you're all thinking, oh yeah, I know old Reinhold. But Reinhold Niebuhr wrote a book called Christ and Culture. And in that book, he described five ways, and we're going to narrow them down to three ways, but three ways that we allow Christ to be a part of culture. And by thinking about these three ways, we're going to see two ways that I think are false and one that is real. We're going to see one way that is like hiding a lamp under a bushel. We're going to see one way that's like losing your saltiness. We're going to find another way that is in fact a reflection of how Jesus was and how he intends for us to be. Reinhold Niebuhr would put it in these three categories. There is the Christ against culture type of Christian. That's the one that's like hiding your lamp under a bushel. There's the Christ of culture Christian. That's the one that loses its saltiness. And then there's the Christ above culture. And that's the one that is a far more biblical representation of how Jesus was and how he intends for us to be. So let's consider for a moment this notion of the Christ against culture. And let's remember Jesus' words where he says this, "You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden." He's not talking about a city that is away from everything, but one is in the midst of everything and that shines in a dark world. It's visible to the world around it. It's not obscure. It's not isolated. It's in the midst of it. And then he contrasts this with a philosophy when it comes to light. He says, Jesus, "Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven." Implicit in what Jesus is saying is the fact that if you are to obey what Jesus is saying here, you have to be in the culture, right? You have to be with sinners. You have to be around people who are dark for the light to shine. You don't want to isolate and hide it somewhere. You don't want to preserve it. You want it to be on display. You want to be a city on the hill. Now, there is a version of Christianity that has migrated the opposite direction of this. This is the Christ against culture type. And we could put a lot of terms to it. We could call this fundamentalism. We could call it isolationism. In the past several hundred years, thousand years, there was a version of Christianity, you may have heard of it before, that did this as a rule. This is how they thought it was supposed to be done. They were the monastics, people like monks, right? Now we know what we're talking about. These are people who isolated in convents and this sort of thing, and they just did their Christianity all completely, all by themselves, never having any impact on the world outside of them. Now, I don't want to draw the conclusion that that is utterly wrong, because I do think there are times that we ought to isolate. And I think there was a reason for it 1,000 years ago that gave them reason to do this. It wasn't all bad, but it certainly turned out to be something that was counterproductive to Christianity as time went on. But there are times that we need to get off by ourselves and away from everything. There are times where the stain of the world is just so much that we need to get by ourselves with Jesus. We call this on a daily basis a quiet time, a time in our sanctuary, wherever that is, where we're spending time with Christ, or perhaps a day a month or every now and then that we go off away from everything so that we can spend time without distraction with Jesus. But guess what the point of this is? The point of getting away is to come back. Jesus did this, didn't he? Jesus spent 40 days in the wilderness. Did he do it so he could hang out in the wilderness forever? No, he did it so he could come back and get on mission for God. There's numbers of times, it's a helpful pattern just to go read the Gospels to see how many times the apostles lose Jesus. Or even his parents lose him one time, you remember that? Where the Mary and Joseph have gone to Jerusalem to worship and they come back and they're like 2 days out and they're like, "Where's Jesus?" Like you have the Son of God, right? One job to do and you lost him? How terrifying was that moment for Mary and Joseph? But the apostles are routinely losing Jesus. And why? Because Jesus is routinely going off by himself to pray. Why? So that he can isolate, but for the purpose of coming back to engage in mission. The problem is when we isolate for the purpose of isolation because we think the world has nothing to offer and we need to get away from it as much as possible so that we can get holy and right with God. I'll give you an example of a person who did this. You may have never heard of him. He's probably the most famous monk ever to live. A guy by the name of Simon the Stylite. Has anybody ever heard of Simon the Stylite? Simon lived from the years 390 to 459. And he is called Simon the Stylite because he chose, as a pattern of being a Christ against culture type of a person, to hide his light under a bushel by living for 37 years on top of a column, way up in the sky, about 40 feet, all by, he built him a little shack up there, and he never came down for 37 years. It's pretty amazing, isn't it? For 37 years, he had a servant who would come and hoist up food to him, and he'd eat it, and he had a bucket that he'd hoist down food and what used to be food down to his servant. And for 37 years, this is how he lived his life. Does that sound like gospel witness to you? Now, the fascinating thing about it is that while he tried to isolate himself from the world, guess what ended up happening to Simon the Stylite? He became a tourist attraction. And so everybody would come to where he lived to go look at the crazy guy living up on top of the column. So you could try to isolate yourself from the world, but guess what? The world will always find you, right? You simply can't do it. The world will always come to you. And the fact of the matter is, if the world didn't, if it was possible for you to go off to Alaska or Montana or wherever to live utterly alone for the rest of your life, no access to technology, nothing, you're simply by yourself, do you know where else the world will be? Within you. You cannot get out of the world because you are the world. When Danielle and I used to do college ministry, I've often thought, I wish we could do this again, and maybe one day we will. We should do something called Theology Theater. And Kara was a part of this. It's one of our favorite things to do. We did it with several movies. The point of it was to watch a Hollywood movie. We intentionally did not watch Christian movies. We wanted to watch a movie that was made by Hollywood so that we could watch it with eyes towards what is the theology being conveyed in what this movie is. What's the worldview? And what was fascinating was with a lot of these movies, even by non-Christian directors and writers, how the Christian worldview would somehow make its way through. And it was illuminating to discover that. Well, one of the movies that we used to do this with was the M. Night Shyamalan movie, The Village. Anybody know the movie? And so the movie is, and by the way, if you've not watched it, you're like, that's what we're going to watch this afternoon, and I'm about to spoil it for you, okay? So in the movie, there is a group of people who have decided to isolate themselves from the rest of society. As the movie unfolds, we discover that they were doing so because of all of the violence and the drug deals and all this sort of stuff that was happening in the modern world. And so they isolated themselves into this community, and they made it as though they were like a 1700s community, in fact, isolated from what was a modern society. And everyone who lived there, the younger generation, had no knowledge of the external world. They all thought it was this kind of Amish type of world. And they had, the story of the movie is that they had invented these fake monsters that lived in the woods to prevent the young people from ever going into the woods to discover what the modern world was actually like. Now, the whole purpose of this was to prevent the world from making its way into the village. But as the movie unfolds, there is this girl who has an attempted murder made against her. And as it happens in the movie, it is the mentally handicapped person in the village who does the attempted murder. And a young man has the attempted murder done against him, and the girl, who is blind, has to go off into the modern world to get medicine to try to save her boyfriend. Now, what I always found fascinating about this story was how the writer chose to convey what I'm exactly describing to you here. They isolated themselves so as to prevent themselves from having violence ever show up. And there it was. And who does the director choose to make the one try to murder? He chooses a mentally handicapped person. And I always thought, why would he choose that? And I think the reason that M. Night Shyamalan chose that person to be the attempted murderer is because M. Night Shyamalan was trying to take the most innocent person in the village and to show that violence was in his heart also. And it's a true thing. This is not just some clever invention of M. Night Shyamalan. It is the reality of humanity. You cannot cut yourself off from the world because the world is within you. You should not hide your light under a bushel because the darkness will overwhelm you if you so choose to do so. Jesus, in fact, would pray for us, wouldn't he? That God would not remove us from the world, but that he would prevent us from being consumed by the evil one. Jesus wants us to, in colloquial terms, be in the world, but not, what is it? Of the world. And so we shouldn't hide our lamp, because to do so is to become irrelevant and impractical at reaching the world for the light of Christ. There are ways, though you may not isolate yourself, and you may not live in a convent, and you may not live on a column, there are ways that we as modern Christians choose to do this. There has been a tendency to make a separation, as it is said, between the sacred and the secular. I'm going to tell you how you are prone to be influenced by the Christ against culture philosophy. Whenever you think to yourself that what I do as a career minister, someone whose job it is to preach the gospel, if you think that what I do is more important than what you do for your job, you have fallen prey to this same mindset. When we think that Sunday morning is more important than Monday morning, we fall prey to this mindset. When we don't realize that God is the God of our entire lives and not just the spiritual segment of our lives, we fall prey to this concept. You see, the reality is that there is no separation. All of life is holy. I love the statement from, I think it was Charles Spurgeon, who said that if you are called to be a plumber and choose to be a preacher, you have chosen disobedience. Do you realize that your life, exactly as you are, where you are, where God has planted you, is God's design for you to represent Him, to shine His light in that place? Your purpose in your job is not to raise money for the church. The purpose of going to Bible study or doing the discipleship class is not so that you can come to church and make disciples. It's so that you can do it where you are. It's so that by being the one that God has designed you to be, doing the job that God has called you to do, you can shine your light before men. And there are ways to do this with your words, by evangelizing, and there are ways to do this with your hands, by simply doing what God has called you to do well. Martin Luther King Jr., my favorite quote from Martin Luther King Jr. is this. He said this: if a man is called to be a street sweeper, he chooses the most mundane job there is, he should sweep streets even as Michelangelo painted or Beethoven composed music or Shakespeare wrote poetry. He should sweep streets so well that all the hosts of heaven and earth will pause to say, here lived a great street sweeper who did his job well. The Apostle Paul would put it this way: whatever you do, whether in word or deed, do all to the glory of God. So let me ask you that question. Do you see where God has you? The work that you do, whether it's at home with children, or whether it's in the public with a plumber, or an electrician, or in a job at Baxter, or as a teacher, or you name it. Do you see that as an opportunity to worship God? Or do you see it as something you do on the side, and your spiritual life is over here? You see, that is hiding your light under a bushel. The second way that we do this, by losing our saltiness, this is the Christ of culture notion. Jesus says this: you are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? There's a surprising thing about what Jesus says here, because do you know what is a fact? It is impossible for salt to lose its saltiness. You can't take salt granules and make them unsalty. But here's what you can do to them. You can mix them with other things that then makes them worthless. That's Jesus' point. Do you know how something loses its saltiness? By being diluted. As a matter of fact, in Jesus' world, one of the things they would use salt for was to mix with construction materials to put on plaster. That is the idea behind what Jesus is saying. How do we do this today? Well, this is where we integrate or blend or syncretize our Christian life with the culture of the world. If the other version, the Christ against culture, was the fundamentalist version of this, this is the liberal version of it. This is to compromise our faith. This is where culture begins to define our Christianity rather than Christianity define us in the culture. Now, there are all kinds of various ways in which this happens. The tendency is for one side to think the other side does it. And so, if you're a conservative, your tendency is to see it only in the liberals. And if you're a liberal, your tendency is to only see it in the conservatives. But the reality is, every variety of person has their form of the Christ of culture. The conservative version of this are those who have allowed Christianity to become defined by their view of an American traditionalism or whatever that might be. Here recently, Danielle and I watched a documentary on the Oklahoma City bombings that was arranged by a number of white supremacist groups, and there were interviews with some of these people, and I was shocked to see the Christian language that these people would use. One of the leaders of a group called the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord was quoted, he was interviewed saying that he says, "The Bible justifies the use of whatever force is necessary." And I thought when he said that, I thought, well, where does it say that? The fact is, it doesn't matter. Because he's not going to the Bible to get his theology. He's getting his theology from his worldview and the culture and bringing it to the Bible. Does that make sense? And it's people like that who bombed the Oklahoma City bombing and other things that have happened along that variety. Think of one of the most vile versions of this is a group known as Westboro Baptist Church. Have you heard of this group? And I hate to even use the language that they use it, but their website is GodHatesFags.com. And one of the things they are known for is going to the funeral of homosexual military people and picketing outside of it. Now, I am not here saying that I am a supportive of a homosexual lifestyle. I believe it is sin. But I also believe hatred of human beings is sin. And when you forget one to embrace the other, guess what you have ceased doing? You have ceased being influenced by the Jesus of the Scriptures, and you have shaped him in your own hateful image. That's the conservative version of this. And there's various varieties that's in our midst as well. But then there's the liberal version of it. I think we're more prone to recognize it because we tend to be on the other side of things. The liberal version of this is very rampant today, is it not? Where the Jesus of culture for the liberal is the one who does support every sexual ethic that there is in variety today. That he does support, you know, your right to change your gender or to marry whoever you want or live with whoever you want or sleep with whoever you want. This is the Christ of culture for the liberals. And to do this, to have this as a part of our lives, is to become so like the culture that you cease to look like Jesus at all. And if you cease to look like Jesus, you've lost your saltiness. And if you've lost your saltiness, you've lost your ability to influence the culture for Christ. I invite you to pause and consider for a moment the way in which this has happened to you. Because I promise you it has. Every single one of us has allowed our culture to influence our worldview in some way. Whether it's money, whether it's sex, whether it's violence, whether it's the types of people we're supposed to let in or let out or whatever it is, we would do well to pause and let the Jesus of the Bible speak to our heart rather than our heart speak to the Jesus of the Bible. Does that make sense? These two that I've just described, I believe, are false ways that we think of Christ's relationship to culture. And to embrace either one of them is to cease to shine a light or to lose your saltiness, but there is a way that Christ means for us to be involved in this world. And in Reinhold Niebuhr's terms, it's the Christ above culture. It is to, in fact, be salty. It is, in fact, to shine a light. Or, to consider it more practically, it is to be against the current of the world, not flowing with the current of the world. It is to be a force that transforms the world rather than a person that the world transforms. This is exactly how Jesus did. You can't, have you ever noticed, peg Jesus down? The moment you think he's going to do one thing, he does the opposite thing. The people you think he ought to condemn, he embraces, and the people he ought to embrace, he condemns. Have you ever noticed this? Because Jesus was not there allowing the culture to shape him. He was there doing something entirely different and shaping it. And when you do that, it doesn't go well. There will be persecution. There will be harm. And Jesus gave his life for it. And the same will happen to many who do it in our own society. But how do we do it? The temptation is for us to think as Christians today that the way we do it is through the traditional means of changing things in the world. You know what the traditional means of changing things in the world are? Money, power, and influence. Using your prestige to push and pull. And that's got us to where we are today. What did Jesus do? Rather than that, Jesus didn't do anything. He was something different. You see, because the reality is, the world in which we live is a mixture. It's important for us to understand that God created human beings in his image. That's what Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 2 teach. And that means every person, saved and lost, man and woman, black and white, no matter what, homosexual, heterosexual, every single one of them are created in his image. And do you know what that means? That means that every single human being, every single culture, has the thumbprint of God on it. And that's dignity, and that's worth celebration, that's worth applauding, that's worth lifting up, that's worth recognizing, that's worth identifying. That's in every person. That's in every culture. However, at the same time that that stamp of God's image is on every single person, at the same time, is something we call original sin. And so while every culture and every person has something of the goodness of God in them, it is at the same time darkened and corrupted by their own flesh. So what did Jesus do to change this? Did he raise up a military? Did he go and try to overthrow Caesar or King Herod? No. The Bible describes this in Romans chapter 8. The Bible tells us that the one who was in the invisible, who was in the image of God, took on the form of sinful man. That he who was God for all of eternity became a human being. He who was in the perfect image of God became like a sinful human being. So that, to use the language of 2 Corinthians 5:21, he who knew no sin would be sin so that you might become the righteousness of God in him. So what did Jesus do? He didn't come moving and shaking and beating and plowing. Jesus came and changed his environment by being something for everyone else. He humbled himself. He became like a sinner. He bore your sin on the cross so that you might become like him. This is what Jesus did for you. How then does this mean for us? You follow in his footsteps. You be like Jesus in the world around you. You shine the light of Christ in the world around you. You be something different. You stand against the tide. You let your salt be. You let your light shine. And in so doing, as you do that faithfully, it will begin to have a changing influence on our world. We don't separate ourselves from the world. We don't become like the world. We get in the middle of the world, and we shine a light. And when we do so, wherever God has planted you, you grow. And so I want to leave you with that thought this morning. Where has God planted you? Will you bloom where you're planted? That is kind of the action step today, is to consider your job, your vocation, where God has you. Some of you enjoy them, some of you don't. Some of you think that you could be doing something different. God has you where he has you for his specific purposes. Are you shining your light? Are you being salty? What would it look like for you where God has you to bloom? What change of perspective might that require of you? So that you not necessarily are doing something different, you'll always be a plumber, a teacher, a mom, but so that you are something different. And by being something different, you might change the atmosphere around you. At least where you are. Not necessarily across the globe, but at least where you are. Let's pray. I pray that you'll take these words and plant them in our hearts and help us, Lord, to adapt and change to them as you would see fit. Forgive us, Lord, where we compromise our faith by walking the way of this world or by withdrawing from this world in any given way. Lord, I pray that we would seek to be in this world, but not of this world. And that since we have a God who became flesh, dwelt among us, so greatly was his love for us that he would sacrifice himself on our behalf, that we were not beneath him to become like us, to dwell in our midst, to become poor like us, that we in like manner would not be beneath the calling that is upon each one of us to be where we are, faithfully representing Christ, humbly, honestly, sincerely, so that in our lives others might see the light of Christ. Help us to be salty. Help us not hide our light under a bushel. We don't have to do dynamic things. We don't have to preach to thousands. We simply must be faithful where you've planted us. Help us be so in Christ's name. Amen.